This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Patricia Churchland. She's a neurophilosopher. She's professor emerita at the University of California, San Diego, and adjunct professor at the Salk Institute. And she's author of many books, including Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. She will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. The talk is called The Brains Behind Morality. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. Now, before we start talking about your work and your book, you're a neurophilosopher. What is the field of neurophilosophy?
Good question. Well, the idea really is that with the wonderful developments in neuroscience, we can begin to see some scientific answers to long-held and long-pondered philosophical questions, questions about the nature of consciousness, about how we learn and remember, about how we know anything about the nature of the external world, how we make predictions. And because neuroscience has developed so extraordinarily within the last 30 years, we can see that there is a kind of interconnection now between the sciences and these grand old philosophical questions. And that's where neurophilosophy resides.
And it's interesting because a lot of people seem to be resistant to that. And in your book, you talk about how when you go through sort of revolutions of ideas, I mean, people didn't want to believe that the sun was in the center of the solar system, and there was a tremendous amount of resistance. And there's something similar going on now. What's at stake now, and what's the nature of the resistance?
I think for some people, it's very worrisome if it turns out, as it likely is going to, that all of our mental states, including our consciousness and our understanding and our thoughts and our feelings, all those things are actually states of the brain. And I think what worries some people is that that likely means there won't be a life hereafter. That once the body dies and once the brain decays and disintegrates, there isn't anything left of me to live on hereafter. Now, interestingly, in many Asian cultures, that's not so much a worry because they never really thought that to begin with. They thought that what lives on are the things that we do here for good or for ill. That what lives on is the impact that we have, the things that we build or the things that we make. But that the self itself, complete with our memories and our feelings and our character, does not go to some astral place and have another life. So I think this worry is a worry that troubles only a portion of humanity.
Well, in many of those Asian cultures, there's not necessarily a belief in some other place, but there is a belief in the transmigration of the soul. So all of those experiences that you had in this life will then go into a new little infant 49 days later or whatever it is.
In some, but increasingly that seems to be a fairly narrow constituency that thinks that all of those things. Now, you'll be interested to know that on one occasion about 25 years ago, several of us from the neurosciences were invited to talk to the Dalai Lama because he really wanted to understand what was known at that time about the nature of the brain. And part of what I needed to do was to discuss with him this idea that there is something that lives on hereafter, and that in the case that it's the soul of the last Dalai Lama, that it goes into an infant. And we talked about how implausible that was. And the greatest part of the implausibility is that we really do know within neuroscience that memories are actually structural components in circuits in the brain itself. So when those circuits disintegrate, there is nothing for a memory to be. And hence, there is nothing to go into the mind of the infant. And he clearly pondered that. And my sense is that over time, he's come to the view that it isn't really plausible that the whole kit and caboodle, as it were, our character, our memories, our personality, is transformed and goes into the body of a newborn.
I think I was thinking about this as I was reading your book. It's not just the idea that if all this is true, there's no heaven. I mean, I think a lot of people can sort of deal with the idea that there's no heaven, but even more, what does it mean about the value and importance of my own life, my own sense of my soul, my own importance, my own sense of meaning? How are those things transformed by seeing oneself as brain?
That's a wonderful question. And in a way, part of the motivation for the book was to suggest that those things don't change. That really is part of our biology, and that the sense of ourselves, the uniqueness of each individual, is really part of our biology. And I wanted to sort of capture that by saying at one point that I actually sort of revel in the biologicalness of myself, in the fact that certain things that I do are very similar to things that a dog will do or a rat will do, or that, and that's especially true in our reproductive behavior. So that when you have a baby, it's as though, you know, your whole body takes over, this baby is delivered, and so much in your brain begins to change. And it changes because there are hormones that are changing, and because there are neurochemicals like oxytocin that are modifying the circuitry so that you feel differently. And all of a sudden you have this absolutely massive love for this child. And I think probably mother rats do too, and mother dogs and mother sheep. And fathers in certain species like humans and marmosets, they also do. And I love the biologicalness of it. I think it's really exciting, and it makes me feel connected to other things in the world in a rather special way.
And there's a whole, I mean, there's many chapters that you write, and this is one of the things that's so interesting, is the morality that we carry around as human beings in many ways stems from, well, first of all, being a mammal.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So social behavior we see in many things, in honeybees, in termites, and so forth. But the sociality that we see in mammals and birds is really very different and has a very different kind of underlying circuitry and is in its way vastly more complex and kind of more interesting. But the funny thing about it is that it came to be, that is, it was selected for in the evolution of nervous systems as a result of something that had really nothing to do with morality, and that is being warm-blooded. So at some point about 200 million years ago, warm-blooded animals appeared. And that was great in many ways, but the downside is you have to eat 10 times as much gram for gram as a cold-blooded animal, because you got to keep yourself going.
Yeah, literally 10 times as much.
10 times as much. So you can see that that's a huge constraint. And the constraint really played out in the following way. It meant that warm-blooded animals had better be smart. And if they're going to be smart, what Mother Nature did was basically take the old learning mechanisms and just scale them up. And that meant that the offspring had to be born immature so that the nervous system could tune itself up to whatever world it found itself in. And that meant that there had better be somebody to care for the dependent offspring that is so immature. And so Mother Nature, so to speak, if I can anthropomorphize, Mother Nature rewired the mammalian brain so that when that offspring appeared, the mother was hugely attached to it. It was as though it were part of herself. So just as she takes care of her own warmth and food and water, she takes care of its warmth and food and water. So we have this massive change in circuitry that extends from self-consideration to consideration of others. And that's the big change in the evolution of the nervous system.
I think it's really an interesting point that you make, that part of intelligence is, the kind of mammalian intelligence, human intelligence that we have, is dependent on being born immature so that we can adjust to our surroundings. So a crocodile doesn't really have to adjust to its surroundings as much, and we do, and that makes us smarter, but it also means that we have to be born with a lot more possibilities.
That's exactly right. And humans, of course, are born, have the longest period of immaturity of any of the mammals. But all mammals require this care on the part of others. And the immaturity can actually be documented at the neuronal level. So we have these pictures of what the neuronal structure looks like in the infant brain, and it's just kind of like a few little small bushes. 2 months later, those bushes have grown a lot. 6 months later, massively. And of course, by the time you're into adolescence and adulthood, you have this tremendously dense interconnection of bushes. And that's all done in response to the environment, in response to experience. And part of what we're learning are social norms. We're learning when it's okay to laugh, when we ought to help, when it's okay to lie, and when we should not, and so on and so forth.
And those things vary tremendously from one society to another, from one time period to another, from one geography to another. Are there any social norms that are common to all or most human societies?
I think there are, and I think there are also things that are in common with chimpanzees and baboons and monkeys. And one, of course, has to do with care of the young, that you don't neglect and abuse the young. We don't know of any society that ever had a rule that said women must take their firstborn, boil it up, and feed it to the dogs. That just does not happen. All societies also seem to have regulations on conflict and assault within the group, but so do chimpanzees and baboons and so forth. There are limits. And we know from anthropologists who have studied small groups of hunter-gatherers, like the Inuit or the Cheyenne or the Comanche, that they did also. So the exact form those limits take depends on the ecology. So it's going to be different for people living in the Amazon basin than the Inuit that live in Alaska. So, yeah, the exact form is going to differ, but there are these broad underlying themes. And I think those are themes that basically come out of this platform of caring for offspring.
What does it mean when we think about ourselves as moral beings who got this way because of evolutionary causes, like being warm-blooded and having to gather more food and therefore having to be smarter and therefore having to be born immature? How does that change the way one might hold morality as being some kind of absolute good or bad when it's really just an evolutionary trait?
Well, it's an extraordinarily important evolutionary trait because it's what allows us to be social animals. And it's only because we're social animals that we can cooperate and we can do things like make bridges and develop modern medicine and so forth. So I think that part of the story is okay. But I think there's a deeper sense in which it's kind of liberating. And the deeper sense goes something like this, that it's a good idea probably not to have morality too closely tied to specific religions, because religions vary in what they insist we do, or in the gods that they believe in. And often those differences provide an excuse for conflict between groups. And I think if we understand that the basic platform for morality is deeply biological, but that the superstructure on that platform can vary as a function of history or charismatic leaders or certain religions taking control and so forth, then I think we can kind of stand back and try to assess those things in a slightly more evaluative way that works better.
Do you see religion as an outgrowth of human evolution?
Well, we do know that that organized religion really did not appear until about 10,000 years ago. So you have to ask yourself, so how long were humans like us, how long were they on the planet? And the answer is about 250,000 years. So for most of our history, we lived in small groups with fairly basic but important kinds of social rules and norms, but without organized religion. And people, we know from anthropologists, say anthropologists who work with the Inuit, that they can be very kind, they have food sharing, they have restrictions on assault and on murder and so forth. So we know that you don't need organized religion in order to have social cordiality, in order to have cooperation in groups. Probably when agriculture became important, communities enlarged, people didn't know each other personally. At that point, probably organized religion came forth as a way of codifying the rules that were already in existence.
Do you count shamanic religions or shamanic practices as organized religion?
Not really, because they would differ from group to group. And it's not to say that the shamans didn't perform useful functions, but by organized religion in this context, and I just mean this as a way of making a distinction, I mean those religions that functioned across individual groups, where there was a commonality of ideology.
We're talking to neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland. Now, just as there are social norms that lead to things like loving our children and cordiality and social norms, there's also in our brains, in our evolutionary history, all kinds of violence and aggression. And not only that, I mean, something that is probably uncomfortable for some people to read in your book, but there's a lot of joy that comes with violence and hatred. And you give some real examples of that. Violence, hatred, and establishment of our group and the hated other group are real opportunities for bonding in many human societies and subgroups.
It does seem to be the case, and we do know that that groups can bind very tightly together and care very much for one another, and that they will go on raids against other groups. We don't know when that began. There is speculation that it was long before there were goods to be had, like property and so forth. But we really don't know. There may have been, prior to the advent of agriculture, there may have been a certain amount of interaction of a warfare kind between groups, but we really don't know. We do know, for example, amongst the Inuit that there was almost none. And that was really because it didn't pay. I mean, what would you get? And how could you sneak up on the tundra where there's no trees? And besides, their dogs will bark. So there really wasn't much. But we do also understand that hatred and aggression can be a very bonding feature for a group, along with things like conventions regarding clothes, rituals regarding marriage, rituals regarding dance, and so forth. But and so one of the things I've been very interested in is the relationship between aggression and hatred on the one hand and pleasure or reward on the other hand. And within neuroscience, it has not yet been very well explored. And And so in writing the book, I speculated really on the basis of my own observations, both as an adult but also as a child, regarding the kinds of pleasures and the kind of bonding, for example, amongst males between about 18 and 25 that happens and that causes them to perform for each other, acquire status as a result of those performances, and then go and beat the snot out of another group.
Yeah, and that performance for each other, I think there's sort of a lot of cultural stereotypes that they're performing for women.
They're not, I think. I mean, up to a point they are, but I think they're mainly performing for each other. And the ultimate end may be for women. That is, that if I am the top guy in these sorts of things and I have behaved with extraordinary recklessness and bravado, then that may seem to me to give me special rights to choose the woman that I want. But I think that they're not really performing, by and large, for women.
All these questions of hatred and aggression and raiding and war and things like that do bring up this uncomfortable question that you write in your book, which is, are things like war and genocide, which have become universals in the millennia of civilization that we've had, are they programmed into us? How do we hold those things?
We, of course, don't really know the origin. I speculate in the book, and there is some basis for this speculation, that aggression is very, very ancient. It certainly predates the appearance of mammals. We know that alligators can be very aggressive. My sense is that aggression requires energy, and it requires you to be up. So if you're a predator, and let's just take a mammalian predator now, let's say it's a wolf. If you and your buddies are going to go after a caribou, that's dangerous. You have to be up. You have to be ready to take risks. You have to find it exciting in order to do it. Otherwise, you'd put your tail between your legs and scuttle off. And so I think that part of what biologically goes into predation and hence into aggression is this feature of energy. And of course, feeling energetic is in itself pleasurable. And so my speculation is that it really goes back to very ancient roots having to do with predation. And I sort of am inclined to think, and maybe I'm just an optimist here, but I'm inclined to think that if we understand that, and if we understand that some of these predilections and dispositions have very ancient biological origins, that then we can take a look at them and say, hey, you know, we don't actually need that. And we can cut that off at the pass.
Yeah, I have often hoped for a giant soccer game or cooking contest instead of war.
Well, and of course, that's part of what those athletic games from the dawn of history. That's what they've been about.
Yeah.
And hunter-gatherer groups, and again, if I may use the example of the Inuit, have very highly stylized, highly structured and systematized rituals when men can fight each other. But they can't just do it on a regular basis because it imperils the safety of the group. And these guys are living next to they're living next to starvation all the time. So it's always been very stylized and generally prohibited. But you do make allowance for it, and especially amongst young men. But of course, as we know, hatred and aggression of a slightly different non-physical form is very much present in females as well.
Well, let's talk about that. What kinds of aggressions do we have in females, and how are those different from, well, how are male and female aggression different?
Well, certainly females have the circuitry for aggression as a result of these massive changes that made for mammals. And in the mothers, of course, mothers have lots of vasopressin as the baby is born, so that they will be ferocious if anyone or any predators should approach. We know that from mother rats. We know it from mother dogs, from mother cats. And so the circuitry is all there to be super aggressive towards anyone who will threaten the young. So the circuitry is there. And under, because we've got these big massive brains that can be very flexible and modify themselves to different conditions, then under certain conditions, women may indeed be somewhat aggressive. But it's relatively rare for women to commit murder. It's relatively rare for them to go to war and with a machete and chop people up. And the fact that there are conflicts within the group between women that have to do with resources, those two in other primates as well as humans tend to be fairly well controlled and are not given sort of free vent.
Now, do we women neurally have kind of different tendencies on how we resolve conflicts?
I think probably, but I wouldn't want to speak to that because I don't know. I mean, I look at everything neurobiologically, and I'm sure there are psychologists who could probably address that more successfully than I can. But from a neurobiological point of view, I can't tell you any circuitry differences that would make for that. But certainly we know that male hormones, of course, are very important in the kind of aggression that men on occasion are capable of. And sometimes it serves us well, and sometimes it serves us poorly.
You write that sexual behavior and violence are linked in the brain, in the hypothalamus. Is this true? Is it true for men and women?
Well, the comment was based on rodent studies, and it's an anatomical proximity. And so it's a surprising finding, and I kind of wanted to mention it only because I wanted people to think about it. But there is a very small structure with it, a very small structure, and the cells within it are all intermixed. And if you stimulate one of those cells, you'll get sexual behavior, but its next-door neighbor will give you aggressive behavior, and its next-door neighbor will give you sexual behavior. So you get this funny intermixing. And so the question really does arise, is it sometimes the case that you need some violence if you're a rodent in order to get the reproductive behavior successful?
I guess I ask because, again, I mean, in the culture in which we live, the term sex and violence are often used as a phrase, sex and violence. And at a certain point in my young adulthood, I thought, now hang on a second. Sex is the most wonderful, sweet thing ever, right, and violence is the most horrible. Why are we linking those?
Yes, of course. And I think that until we know more about what the human anatomy looks like, we shouldn't draw too much by way of conclusions regarding this anatomical finding in rodents. I think there is a funny sort of a link. Here's what's always puzzled me, and that is one often understands that after battle, and we know this for as long as there is history, that after battle, men will rape. Now, what's the point of that? And now people have come up with various kinds of scenarios, you know, like they are producing more offspring and so forth, but often they rape the women and then they kill them. So that doesn't seem like you're sort of spreading your genes. So it is a very big puzzle, and it may be it's just one of those weird bits of behavior that wasn't selected for, that it's just something we do and shouldn't do, and it can be, you know, sort of brought to a halt.
Do we see any other species doing that kind of thing?
Well, it is known that chimpanzees will kill individuals in the neighboring tribe for territorial reasons. Richard Wrangham observed this, and it was very disturbing when we discovered that that did happen. And the killing was done not just in a sort of prey-predator fashion where you do it quickly and it's over and done with. It seemed really horrible. That is, they would sneak up on a lone individual at the boundary of his territory. They would often rip the testicles off. They would rip the eyes out. They would kill it in an abominable fashion. Not unlike the kinds of killing that we know are recorded by humans from the dawn of history.
Do they rape?
Do they rape? That's a complicated question. I don't know how to answer that. Yeah. I think not. In that context, that is to say, I think that if they are in the business of securing more territory and killing off male individuals, I don't think that they then go in and find the females and rape them. You're, of course, asking a question about the nature of chimpanzee sexuality in general. And as we know, it's a little different from bonobo sexuality, where the bonobos seem to have a reproductive behavior that's rather more like humans, more voluntary, more pleasurable, more fun, and so on.
Yeah, I've noticed that when you talk to people who are looking at the animal world to help us understand human nature, the people who look at the bonobos are people who want to have a nice, happy
yes,
view of
yes,
human nature.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And the ones who look at other kinds of chimps will look yes. more at what our dark side is.
Yes. But, of course, it's important to remember that humans diverged from chimpanzees about 5 million years ago, maybe longer, and that the humans from which we came were probably quite different after 100,000 or 200,000 years. And we don't really know, of course, what Homo erectus was really like or what the Neanderthals were really like. But we do know that Neanderthals, of course, interbred with humans. And I actually did have my DNA analyzed to find out if I had any Neanderthal genes, because I thought, well, wouldn't that be interesting? And sure enough, the result came back that I have 4.9% Neanderthal genes.
What does that mean to you?
Oh, I just, again, you know, it's because I sort of revel in the biologicalness. I think, oh my God, it gives me a connection to the very deep past of all of these different species of humans. So that it's not just Homo sapiens, but hey, I'm connected to the Neanderthals, who are probably connected to, ultimately, the Australopithecines, and they are connected, and I think, oh my God, it's so wonderful. Yeah, I love it.
We're talking to neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland. I'm going to guess that there are quite a number of things, and maybe you can expand on this a little bit, that have a deep biological basis and are morally prohibited, like greed, for example, or, well, warfare, we're not sure, rape, maybe not so much, but...
Of course, yes, of course. I mean, it's important in the context of thinking about mammals and the rewiring for sociality to remember that all of those really important structures for self-care did not vanish. And so what we have is this tremendous complexity where there's always a balance between self-regarding behavior and other-regarding behavior. And we know that when we are altruistically engaged, that there is a kind of satisfaction or a kind of pleasure that comes as a result of that. And that we respond very positively to social approval, and we respond very negatively to social disapproval. And we can see that in the brain of the human itself. And so part of what human culture involves is the establishment of norms that allow for the regulation of these conflicts between my own preferences and the needs of the group. And these are always negotiated. They are reinforced by approval and disapproval and sometimes by punishment of a stronger sort. But we also see that in other animals. We see it in wolves. We see it in chimpanzees. We see it in monkeys. And we see it in dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a dog, it's so easy to see how they respond positively to approval and how their ears go back and their tails go down when you disapprove and they don't do it again.
Right. Except when they do. I'm just saying,
well,
I have
yes.
a puppy. But anyway.
Yes.
No, but it's interesting, too, because dogs and some other primates who you talk about in your book, I think it was bonobos, have especially these bonobos, have a sense of fairness. And so
yeah.
there was this great experiment where you give two different bonobos a piece of cucumber and they're happy. But you give one a piece of cucumber, one a piece of fruit, and the one who got the fruit is happy and the other one is filled with moral outrage. And so that sense of fairness, it turns out, is only fairness for me. And that transition from fairness for me to fairness for the group, like that person over there didn't get a piece of fruit and it's
yeah.
not me. That seems like is that a big leap? Is that a big neural or evolutionary leap?
It's hard to say. And let me just say one thing about that experiment. It was done at Emory University in Franz de Waal's lab, but they were actually capuchin monkeys.
Oh, monkeys, that's right.
Yeah, so we don't know. Sarah Brosnahan is actually looking at what would happen in the case of chimpanzees. But, you know, it's very interesting. You draw the right conclusion from the experiment with capuchins, namely they weren't upset. The one who got the grape didn't say, hey, you know, what are you doing? But here's what's also interesting, and this comes from Franz de Waal, who's such a genius in observation, and that is that, you know, we see conflict resolution behavior in all mammals. We see it in dogs, we see it in monkeys, and we also see consolation behavior. So that when one animal is defeated, the others come around, they put their arms around it, or if you're a dog, you lick it, and so forth. And these behaviors you can think of as having a cost. I mean, I could be out picking berries, but here I am consoling this individual. So they have a kind of a cost, but it is also very pleasurable. We think that the circuitry provides pleasure in this kind of behavior. So yes, there is limits to the kind of fairness that we see in the capuchin monkeys. But he also then went on to show that in capuchins, if given the choice, one for me and one for my pal, or two for me, they most often make the pro-social choice. One for me and one for my pal. That's pretty interesting, because
yeah.
that's food.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they are willing to take a personal sacrifice to give the other something. So I wouldn't make too much of that fairness experiment in terms of it's not generalizing. So we would have to wait and see about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a field in which there's so much that isn't known. It must be a very exciting field for you to be in.
Well, it is, because when I was a graduate student, people said, we are the only ones who have anything like moral behavior.
Right.
And here was de Waal saying, look, there's consolation behavior, conflict resolution behavior, pro-social choice. And people used to say, we're the only ones who can reason, that all of the other animals, it's just reflex. And now we know they reason by analogy, just pretty much like we do. And lots of our reasoning involves language, but lots of it does not.
That's another thing that you talk about, is the nature of consciousness, to what extent language plays a role in our consciousness or in any consciousness.
Yeah. My own guess is that prelinguistic infants, human infants, are conscious, and that other mammals are conscious, that other birds, ravens, crows, and so forth are conscious. It may not be just like it is for me, but then maybe, you know, when you're conscious, it's not just like it is for me either. But we know that all of these animals, their brains look the same when they go into deep sleep. It's all reorganized when you go into deep sleep, just like mine. They know that they respond to anesthetics just like I do. The brains look just the same. So I think it's very reasonable to think that consciousness is a very fundamental feature, at least of mammals and birds, but I'm guessing probably more than that. And when you have language, then you may have a certain kind of information compression that allows us to exchange information in a very efficient way. But I don't think that gives you consciousness.
Does the fact or the recognition of consciousness in so many other creatures besides us, and as you say, that's a pretty recent development. That's one that's happened during your own academic career.
Absolutely.
Does that change the kind of social morality that we are living with? Does it open a sense of morality up to other living things?
Well, those are really, really interesting and difficult questions. And, you know, living on a farm, our view, my father sort of set this, and I think my mother too, was that we have to eat, and you guys are growing, and you certainly have to eat. And so we take care of our animals in the best way possible, but when we have to eat them, we kill them in the most humane way possible. And that's sort of been a standard for me, is that I'm quite prepared to do that. I think that in the case of using animals for medical research, again, those sorts of protocols are pretty much what everybody follows, whether you're using rats or mice or whatever, that you take the best care possible, and then when you need to do something, you do it in the most humane way possible.
Right, which is, I mean, I have to say, one of the things that I loved about your book, Patricia Churchland's book, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is called Touching a Nerve, the Self as Brain, is that you really got a sense of your own roots growing up on a farm in Canada and the kind of the way you guys treated each other and the kind of moral examples that came up as a for you as a young person, like the very charming accountant who stole money from the community. And that was sort of shocking, you know.
It was. I mean, all of those, when you live in a very small village and everybody is a farmer and everybody knows everybody else, you pretty much know what's going on. But people, we didn't have television. We did have radio, of course, but there was no television. And so people talked. And so people would come over and they'd sit around and have coffee and they'd hammer out these things. And some people would take one view and another and so forth. And as a child, I would just sit there and listen. And then after people would go, my father, who was always willing to talk to me about it, he would tell me how he saw things. And he was very important too because my mother thought we should go to Sunday school, and I would hear these stories like Abraham and Isaac and how Abraham was willing to kill his son with a knife because God told him so. And I came home and I talked to my father about this, and I said, you know, this is scary to me. And so we talked it through, and he basically said, it's a story. It is a scary story. And Abraham must have been nuts. And that was very reassuring to me that my father wasn't nuts, Abraham was nuts, it wasn't going to happen to me.
Right. Yeah, there's so many questions, there's so much more that we can talk about. I'm glad you're going to be speaking tonight because you can get into even more of this. But one of the things that you write about is restraint and self-control, and there's a lot of what we think about as morality is grounded in, you know, there's all kinds of things that we might want to do that we don't do. And I have found myself over the years at different times wondering whether any one of us, me or you or whoever, if we refrain from doing bad stuff, is that because we have internalized a deep sense of inner morality, Or is it the rule of law and mm-hmm. we know what's going to happen to us if we do such and such?
I think it's both. I think sometimes when the dilemma is before us and it involves something that doesn't come under a legal jurisdiction, when it involves, you know, say, helping a friend in a certain kind of way, then it's all about the rules and norms we've internalized. And of course, bear in mind, those rules are not consistent, right? We've internalized inconsistent rules. That's the nature of human society. And so sometimes we feel the conflict. We feel the ambivalence. But of course, over and above that, in a huge society, as all modern societies are, there is the rule of law. And so the prospect of detection and punishment is very real. I mean, I think that it's obvious that if the IRS never checked up on anybody and did an audit, that more people would cheat. Now, I've asked myself, would I cheat? And I think, well, you know, if I thought everybody else was, maybe I would. And so many of these factors play into our decisions. But you're right, of course, that self-control is a huge part of the story. And it is a biological brain phenomenon. And we know quite a bit now about how self-control actually works in nervous systems.
Is self-control something that has to be taught? Is that something that young learn from their elders?
Well, I think the specifics of what you learn are taught, but the capacity to learn self-control is certainly there. And in any social animal, there is approval and disapproval, and that plays right into the control system. And so, you know, when you have a nursing infant, you know, after a few months, like say 6 months and they begin to get teeth, they may bite you when they're suckling. You know, you yelp and you say, don't you ever do that again. And they don't. And basically what's happened is that was disapproval. That engaged their subcortical structures in the reward system. That changed the very structure of the reward system. So they are very unlikely to do it again. Well, you might have to repeat it, but they'll get the idea.
Right.
And similarly, you know, with toilet training, I mean, that's all about approval and disapproval and learning what's okay and when it's not okay. And children who are young, who are two and even younger, can very easily pick it up.
And it turns out that some people and even some dogs have much better natural capacity for self-restraint than
without
others.
Without doubt. And we can see it in rodents, too.
Yeah.
Some rodents can easily learn to defer gratification in a very specific test, and others, they're just never very good at it. And it is true of dogs.
It's very true of dogs. And you were talking about even two golden retriever puppies from the same litter might have different capacities toward self-restraint, and one of them ends up being a mischievous house dog and the other ends up being maybe a helper or therapy dog.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are differences in capacities, and I think one of the great things that psychologists have done is to try to find ways of helping kids with poor self-control acquire a greater capacity for it. And these things actually work. I mean, it involves teaching the child to imagine the situation before it happens and to imagine what they're going to do in it, for example. And these really rather simple strategies actually can end up being amazingly helpful.
Yeah, because children with the most self-control tend to do better in life. I mean, these studies follow them over a whole lifetime.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so you do really want them to acquire a robust capacity for self-control, and the earlier the better, really. And if you take into account the fact that there are differences between children and you've got a child, you know, for whom it's difficult, you just have to put in a greater effort and have to figure out strategies to help that child. And just sort of, you know, bashing it isn't necessarily the best strategy, of course.
Patricia Churchland is a neurophilosopher. She's professor emerita at the University of California, San Diego, and adjunct professor at the Salk Institute. Her latest book is called Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain, and she will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. The talk is called The Brains Behind Morality. I want to thank you so much for being with us this hour on the Radio Cafe.
Hugely enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.